Hello and welcome to the 11th Adamola Bookman podcast, where my co-host John Coughlin and me, Alistair Bond, read footballers' autobiographies and discuss them. So, hi Tom Doran, you've got your book. It's Steve Claridge's Tales from the Boot Camps, which is niche even for us.
Thanks, Tom. Very kind of you to recommend a book. So,
and indeed,
Steve
send it to Ireland. Like,
yeah, particularly kind. Yeah, particularly kind. Yeah,
anyone can recommend something, but it costs fucking money to post it to Ireland.
Yeah. So, what did you know about Claridge then before this?
Socks Rolled Down is right. My number one thing.
Okay.
I always remember him for that. I mean, as I may have mentioned, I'm a few years older than you, Johnny, and also have supported a team that's not necessarily in the top division. So it's a name I'm familiar with. I mean, I grew up in Leicestershire, so I knew of Claridge. And I always liked him. He always seemed like a decent, good egg. He looks like a plumber. I mean, he doesn't look anything like a footballer. He looks like a plumber who's just wearing a football shirt. A decent striker for the lower divisions.
Yeah,
what do you know about Steve Claridge, Johnny?
Claridge, I wouldn't have known much really. You know, I know the name, I recognize him, I've definitely seen him in games over the years. But if you had tried to pin me down and say who did he play for, I'm not sure I necessarily could have done that for you. Was he on Sky for a while as a pundit?
I had a look at this. He was on BBC as a pundit for a while, but he was always fucking late, so he got sacked.
Unbelievable. So, okay. Did you know about his gambling?
No, I don't think I did, no.
And when I read the introduction of the book, and it's all about his gambling, and we done Paul McGrath, and okay, Maradona, obviously the drugs, but that wasn't depressing in the way McGrath was. So I read about Claridge's gambling in the start, and I was just like, oh my goodness, not another one like this. So they go really heavy on the gambling, and then he doesn't really mention it again.
Well, he mentions it in bits of starts. I've got a bit better. I've had a few winners. Yeah, he doesn't see it as an illness. Like, maybe it would be approached in a book nowadays. So when was this book written, Johnny? It was written in the late 90s, is that right? 1997, which is absolutely ages ago now, isn't it? When you think 27 years ago.
Yeah, and like we made fun of Vardy in our first episode for releasing a book after winning the league. Claridge released this book after getting Leicester promoted. That's what he was doing here, because it came out the year after that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the co-writer Ian Ridley writes for the Guardian, the Observer, right?
Right. Yeah, definitely Guardian at some stage. Yeah.
Well, he says he approached him to release this book, and in all fairness, there's more of a story than there is in Jamie Vardy's, right?
Hmm.
But it is a funny book.
And it is a funny book.
I've been dying to get this comparison out. Like, so last time out, we read Diego Maradona. This time we read Steve Claridge. It feels to me like it's like going from watching Scarface, like an incredible bonanza of excess and vice. And you finish watching Scarface, and then you put on the TV, and then it's UK Gold, and you're watching one episode of Men Behaving Badly, right? That's how I see this book, and it's not fair to compare Steve Claridge to Diego Maradona, is it? It's not, and it's not fair to compare the books, but it's really, we've gone from this opus to like this. I mean, it's a slim book; it's a slim tome anyway of like just pratfalls and pranks, like
From opus to novus.
I'll take that. Not to say it's terrible. It's not. It's just, it's not Maradona's book. But again, that's not Steve Claridge's fault. That's not Steve Claridge's
well,
fault.
Well, it is really. If he had just set out and maybe set his ambitions a little higher, then the book would have been better for it. But you're right. It's not a bad book. It's an entertaining book. And Claridge is a likable character. And I suppose not dissimilar to Southall in that Claridge is a bit odd, isn't he?
Yeah, he is a bit odd. And I don't think he understands how odd he is at times.
Yeah, he's a total oddball. the kind of themes throughout the book are he's constantly late. He's apparently filthy. And yeah, he just seems to be kind of walk around with his head in the clouds a bit. And I do wonder, what's interesting, actually, I thought of Crouch, and Crouch saying that kind of where you played on the pitch was similar to your personality ultimately. According to him in the book, Large, and to others, he was really, really hard working on the pitch and never stopped running. Whereas off the pitch, he just sounds like a total, whatever kind of wastrel kind of character, doesn't he?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, as I say, he does look like a plumber, and he does appear to have a workman's like idea of timekeeping. You know, he'll be along as and when he needs to be. Also, I mean, what would he have been if he'd not been a footballer? He would have been working on a market stall, right? There's a lot of fruit and veg in this book as well. A lot. Yeah.
Well, he just knew he was never going to be in that world, though, didn't he? He knew he was going to be a footballer. So Claridge seems to have been quite gifted from a sporting point of view. Ultimately, as a soccer player, as a footballer, but he was a top-quality tennis player, even though he seems so far removed from that world. And a great cricket player when he was a kid. Played county or whatever the expression is.
Yeah, decent. Yeah, he was picked for his age group for all sports, apart from football, which annoyed him.
Yeah, well, it would, I suppose. But yeah, let's get stuck into Steve Claridge.
All righty, Steve Claridge. Okie dokie. So Steve Claridge was born in 1966, and he had adopted parents, Alan and Anne.
Yeah. Introduction goes really heavy on the gambling, and apparently this was his reputation all throughout football, that he was stone mad for the gambling and would peel off at various occasions to put on a bet. He'd come to training with cash in his tracksuit and would peel off at various points and gamble. He reckons he lost £300,000 sterling in gambling over the course of his career, which I suppose when you consider that's like what David De Gea or someone would get paid in a week.
I mean, that's it. I mean, that right from the go, you're like, 300 grand. I mean, that I was thinking, like, there was talk of, like, the England players back under Sven's days used to gamble on the back of a bus, like, and, like, they get on the bus and, like, 3 hours later when they got off the bus, Michael Owen would be, like, 60 grand poorer because he's been rinsed by one of the England players. And yeah, in that perspective, like, 300 grand, is that all? But you've got to put it into perspective, haven't you? Because he really was earning, like, 300 quid a week, like, back in the days.
When he started out and he played low, like non-league football, he was earning a pittance, right? But he talks about money a lot in the book, doesn't he?
He does talk about money a lot, but he also says he's not bothered about money. But that's something that all footballers say, isn't it? I think
they all say that.
Every single one.
Yeah.
Every single book, they're like, oh, I'm not motivated by the money. I'd love to read a book where they are motivated by the money. Yeah, he's not motivated by money, so he says, although he's chasing it all the time by gambling.
But so
Although that is something different, isn't it? That is something different. Gambling is a sickness.
He does say it's a sickness, but as you say, it's not something that, like, and he seems to have, by the end of the book, conquered it or managed it somehow. But it goes heavy in the introduction, but then it kind of, that's like it's weaved in and out here and there, but never in any kind of serious way. If he's had really dark moments with gambling, he doesn't get into it in this book. This is an extremely light book.
It certainly is. Yeah, and there seems to be no stakes, really, because there's no family to speak of. He never mentions his kids at any point, right? So I don't think, to my knowledge, he doesn't have any kids. Dunn came up when I Googled him.
He's married.
I mean, I think he's to Mandy, right? She pops up about twice, so I'm still waiting for the sex. Still waiting for that from the book. Yeah, he has got a wife, Mandy, who pops up about twice, and generally, she's involved in an anecdote in as much that he goes on a football training camp to
Magaluf.
But he tells her he's going to Scotland. But then she came with his dad to pick him up from the airport, and the plane came in from Magaluf and not from Scotland. More than that, he's like, oh, she wouldn't have been happy to hear about that, because Magaluf is apparently AIDS capital of the world, where couples copulate on the beach, so he tells us.
Oh, go on.
What? Magaloo? What? That's weird.
And then he says that he tried it again the following year.
Yes, man.
Not the copulating on the beach, but the telling his wife that he was going to Scotland or somewhere where when this time he went to Tenerife, but he was walking down the street with Andy a few months later, and he met a player from Grimsby who had also been there and was recounting how they'd been up until 5 o'clock in the morning drinking in Tenerife, which was news to Andy.
I mean, that's basically what happened. Although he wasn't walking down the street, he was at Wookiee Hole. He'd gone on a trip to Wookiee Hole where he met another Grimsby player.
What's Wookiee Hole? I've no idea.
Wookiee Hole, it's like a thing in England. I'm not really sure what it is. I think it's a cave.
So that's what he gets up to with Mandy.
Yeah, no one's ever written that. Yeah, so that was basically Mandy's involvement in the whole book, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He just tells a couple of anecdotes about how he deceived her about where they go. And you're going on a football training camp, lad. It's all right. You can tell your wife that. Yeah, the team are going off to training. I mean, surely she'd understand. You're not going, Steve. Maybe that's why he's always late for everything. He's like having to lie to his wife about where he's going. Maybe she thinks he is a plumber or he sells fruit and veg.
The other...
You know, Steve, oh, just driving off to Luton for no reason, really. So, yeah, so we hear about his... Well, we don't hear about his wife. We hear a lot about his gambling. But as I say, it just seems to be him, right? He normally has enough for a train fare home or something. It's not like he's going hungry. It's not... It just doesn't seem to have impacted others in a way that makes it significant. Do you see what I'm saying?
He doesn't strike me as being heartbroken or crippled by it or anything. It seems to have been a problem, but... As I say, it's a light book. Maybe he just doesn't bother getting into it or whatever, but you wouldn't read this book and compare it to McGrath in terms of like the horror that it caused to various people around him or whatever.
No, indeed. I mean, he talks about it in comparison to other vices, and he rightly says, you know, you can be an alcoholic, but you can't ruin yourself in an afternoon. Whereas, yeah, with gambling, you can lose so much that you're at a point you'll never catch up in like the space of an hour.
So to give a... I thought what was a good illustration, he seems to be kind of like, he strikes me as a character who kind of has his head in the clouds a bit, right? So when he was a young fella, he was brought on this associate schoolboy terms by his local team, Portsmouth. And so they took on, like, I think it was, he said 240 kids. So it's essentially all the kids in the region who are any good. And then after a year, a couple of years, and this was when he was 14. And then when he was 16, he was one of four of those kids who was brought on as like a YTS kid. New training scheme kid. But then he's there for a couple of years. He's playing under Alan Ball, former World Cup winner. He thought Alan Ball was amazing, but he explained to Clarity, Clarity was always late, and he wasn't going to the school classes that Portsmouth had put on for these kids. So he was let go. And he was given a £500 kind of payoff, I suppose, maybe like to soften the blow. And he went to the bookies and blew it all within 3 or 4 hours. So that was... I guess 18-year-old or 17-year-old Clarich.
Yeah, his gambling is like the raison d'etre for the book, right? It's the big thing, the opening start, but I don't know. I just can't see where it ever affects him terribly.
He's booted out of Portsmouth, and okay, one of the other themes that he repeats throughout the book, and you know, he said he doesn't care about money. So he would go down a couple of divisions to play rather than to hang around. He's the anti Caoimhín Kelleher. If you want.
Yeah, he'd much rather be playing. Eh? I mean, he genuinely loves football, although not training, but he'd rather be playing in a lower division than in the reserves for a good team.
Can I read you a passage, actually, Al? I thought this
yes,
was...
Yes, please.
So when he was at Portsmouth in the YTS, I also had to undergo the initiation ceremony conducted by the second year apprentices. I was stripped naked and boot polish was applied to every part of my anatomy. And I mean every part, with a shoe brush, though a fairly soft one, fortunately. I then had string tied around my wrists and genitals and was led out blindfolded onto a training pitch and tied to a goalpost. Then a sprinkler hose was turned on, and I was left for what seemed like hours. I think the idea was that the water would wash off the polish, but it didn't work out like that. It took hours of bathing, and for days I was finding areas still black. Ah, the male bonding process, the rites of passage.
Yeah, man, that's what happened to me when I started my last job. I was just...
Holy God. You know the way he says later on, he's approached by fellas all the time who said, oh, I could have been a professional footballer. I was good enough or whatever. And his point is, if you could have been a professional footballer, you would have been a professional footballer. The work ethic is part of it, or all the rest of it. There must be some who just gave up after the initiation ceremonies, surely.
Yeah, I would have said so. And maybe not in today's game. That's why it's so much more cultured. That's why Phil Foden can control the ball in short spaces, because when he was 11, he wasn't fucking
traumatized for the rest of his fucking
life. Duct taped to a goalpost for people fucking apply boot polish to him.
But this, well, sorry, on the work ethic thing, I found it funny that Claridge would like get up on his high horse about work ethic, because this guy, well, he seems to have run around when he was on the field. That was his reputation as a player. But he seemed like a fellow who was just kind of phoning it in for a lot of the time, I thought.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, not a trainer. I mean, that's what everyone
says he's
interviewed about him. The worst trainer.
The worst trainer ever. He'd be peeling off to go to the bookies and stuff.
And we'll make excuses as to why he doesn't have to do rituals. There's a couple of times, like, you've got to have a cold shower, lads. All the lads are doing it. Like, oh, I've got a heart problem.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been enjoying that. Like, I would have been looking down my nose at him for that. Like, get him a shower, lad.
Yeah.
He leaves Portsmouth and he goes to Aldershot.
Yeah.
And this is basically the genesis of the book, right? Because the writer, Ian Ridley, is an Aldershot fan. So he knew of him. And he interviewed him every time, and he interviewed him when he returned. And so I think they had a sort of relationship going on.
Yeah.
The format of a book is strange, right, Johnny, isn't it? Because
I would say bad.
You'd say bad.
Yeah.
It's just padding, right? I think perhaps they got to the end of all these stories and realised we haven't really got enough for a book here. So Ian Ridley steps in. So what happens is the writer Ian Ridley writes biography, and then Steve Claridge there's a chapter of autobiography, basically exactly what Ian Ridley's just said, but he just says it in his own words.
Exactly.
So you just tend to get some of the bigger stories, the anecdotes, more than once. And of course, by the time you get Claridge's anecdote, it's already been ruined by Ian Ridley writing it in the biographical way. So you lose some of the clout of even Steve Claridge's voice.
There's one story when he's playing at Weymouth, and there was a bit of money to kind of make Weymouth go up to the Football League, and they had new pitch and all the rest of it. And there was a big push, but at some point the pitch got waterlogged. There was something to do with the sprinkler system underground or whatever, and the pitch got waterlogged, and that kind of derailed the whole season. But that story's in there three times.
Yeah, but it was such a good story. Just keep hearing about it, I've often wondered why Weymouth stuttered so badly in the late 80s.
So close.
But that's why.
On the money thing at Weymouth, he was earning £90 a week. So £90 a week, and that was a 40 pound. He was briefly between Pompey and Weymouth. He was briefly at Bournemouth, where he was earning £50 a week. So he got a £40 a week increase when he went to Weymouth. So yeah, 300 grand, if you're earning £90 a week, it's pretty significant.
That is a significant amount of money. Yeah, absolutely. And who was his manager at Bournemouth, Johnny?
You see him there. You see him everywhere, right? Harry Redknapp.
Yeah, he pops up again and again in these books, doesn't he? There's always a lot of Harry.
There's a good story from Bournemouth. I think Harry Redknapp liked Claridge, but he thought he was a total oddball, which I think is probably accurate. And he kind of freaked everyone out in Bournemouth because he had a habit of cutting chunks out of his hair.
I had a mate like that once.
Honestly?
Yeah, he did. Like, it all seemed like a good idea. It's some real wacky stuff,
Okay, fair enough. It's a thing. Anyway, but that was kind of, I think Harry kind of didn't fancy him because he thought he was a weirdo.
Harry also knew he was a gambler already by the time he was a kid, eh? And bets him he can't run around a playing pitch in less than a certain, well, he's a certain amount. He's got to run around something, and he's got to run around in less than a minute.
He's got to set a record for running around.
He's got to set a record.
The training camp.
Bets him 100 quid. And he duly does it, but Harry reneges on the bet.
And Harry kind of set up various obstacles and all the rest. But like, what if Harry Redknapp, what an understanding man.
Yeah. Well, you like a bit of a gamble? Well, here's one for you, son.
he did well at Weymouth, obviously, because that was kind of, he made a bit of a name for himself in the lower leagues, and that was what he was there for a couple of years. Didn't make it back up into the Football League, but he impressed enough that he was actually, Barry Fry was going to buy him at this point.
Where was Barry Fry? Was he at Basingstoke?
He was a Baronet, maybe, was it?
Oh, that sounds right. Yeah, Flashman, all that business.
He was a Baronet. And then another fellow from Basingstoke also reached out, but a certain Steve Coppell from Crystal Palace came calling instead. And he was off to the, I guess it was the old second division.
Yeah, that's it. He spoke to Barry Fry just after he spoke to Crystal Palace and told him that Crystal Palace had been in for him. Oh, we got no bleeding chance there now, do we? No, you don't. No, you don't. A big name like Palace comes a-calling. Off you go.
Yeah, exactly. But it didn't
work
out.
Would you believe it? The traffic in South London's really bad, Johnny. Traffic in South London's really bad, and he was late. He was late on his first day. That is something he always is, honestly.
He scores against his old team, and he's constantly late. And by the way, would you get in a car if Steve Claridge was driving?
No, I wouldn't.
He's crashing cars left, right, and centre in this book.
I mean, all the time, there's a bit where he writes, no, I'm not a bad driver. Oh, contraire, sir, you are a terrible driver.
Like, one of the things, like, he drives around in shitty old cars for whatever reason, and they're always filthy, and they break down, and he sometimes just leaves them at the side of the road.
He's a busy boy.
Such a strange man. I'll just leave that and get that later. That's not a problem.
Just going back to his driving, in some of my research for him, in 2008, he was arrested doing 100 miles an hour in what was described as treacherous conditions and got a six-month suspended jail sentence. He really is a shit driver. He really, really is.
Like, to get a six-month suspended sentence for a driving offence, you must really be fucking around.
Well, doing 100 in the rain. This has made me think like Austin Powers. You know, in Austin Powers, where the henchman, like, and the henchman gets killed, but then it cuts to his family go, birthday next week. And I just think of all the people that Claridge crashed into. Here's another funny story. Like, it's like, oh no, I've lost my no claims bonus. Oh, daddy, why are you late for my birthday party? Oh, this idiot footballer crashed into me. Like, yeah, I mean, he's a terrible, terrible driver because he's always late, right? He's always late. Just leave half an hour early. Just leave half an hour early, sir.
And also, okay, he's from Portsmouth and he's a real homebird, but he just stayed with his parents for pretty much his whole career, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, no matter what club he played for, eh? Off he goes, like, I'll just drive up. I'll drive up from Portsmouth.
Yeah, come on, man. Like constantly late. Do you know what I should do at this club? I should continue staying with my parents. Like, he's playing for Luton or whatever.
I believe he built a house right next to his parents.
Yeah. Yeah,
and now
exactly.
Lives in a house right next to his parents, which is cute.
Well, you see with Claridge is it doesn't work out for him at various places, and Palace is one of them. Again, I think some people are put off by his demeanour, maybe, and his attitude. Bad trainer, always late, but apparently quite good. But in the Palace instance, I think it was just bad timing. He was there for the Right and Bright show in the late 80s. So,
and he wasn't getting in front of them lads, was he?
No.
He bemoans that just after he left, that's when they sold both Wright and Bright, and he might have had a chance. But you can understand him wanting to move on from there. Like, he's not going to get a sniff.
Obviously, it's in his book, right? So people say nice things about him. Like, maybe they wouldn't be going around putting in comments about people saying that he's a total wanker and all the rest of it. But people do seem to have a lot of nice things to say about him. And he doesn't have much bad to say about anyone. He criticizes Palace for the outsized influence that Wright and Bright had and how they could kind of do whatever they wanted because they were essentially running the show from a footballing perspective on the pitch. But that's really as bad as it gets. He's never really that. Yeah, he doesn't really seem to have many enemies or anything like that.
Well, I've got two that spring to my mind. One is old John Beck, Becky Beck.
Oh, and he hates John Beck.
And the other is Karen Brady. Doesn't like Karen Brady either. All right, so from Palace, that's where he goes to Aldershot. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I have a little note here that I should read out something on page 88. So let's have a look at that. "People say there are no characters left in the game these days," says Phillips. Who the fuck is Phillips?
This is a quality weapon. Scottish defender Ian Phillips.
Okay, sorry. All right, let me do that again. "People say there are no characters left in the game these days," says Scottish defender Ian Phillips. "They've obviously never met Steve Claridge. I remember his first day of training. He turned up in a battered green Escort, which should have gone for scrap. It was always full of rubbish then, and always was afterwards. We thought it was a skip. Whatever he read or ate was thrown down in it. He used to leave it unlocked in the hope that someone would steal it, I think. He also used to hide all his cash in it because there was some problem with his bank account and the club couldn't pay his wages when we got them." They weren't getting paid at all, they're shot. "Yes, we knew all about his gambling. I think he bet most of his wages. A few of us would talk about the horses and his ears would prick up. He would always tell you about when it went well, blah, 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 blah." Anyway, I just thought it was, you know, it was an interesting, insight.
Well, Scottish defender Ian Phillips contradicts himself. Right, it just in the space of 2 seconds. "He used to leave it unlocked in the hope that someone would steal it, I think. He also used to hide all his cash in it." Which one is it, Ian?
Yeah, so off to Aldershot, where he wasn't paid for 15 months.
Money. Who needs it? But Steve Claridge could always fall back on selling a bit of fruit and veg.
Yeah, so
that was a fallback for him. His dad was a farmer.
Say that again?
He was a farmer.
Okay.
In fact, he wasn't a farmer, but he got into farming, right? He wanted to be a farmer. And apparently one of the clubs, I can't remember which one, when his dad turned up for the training and started talking to him, "Oi, Steve, come down here." He got called Wurzel Gummidge. So,
yeah, that was fun, yeah.
Creative engineering. That would be embarrassing, wouldn't it, if your dad sounded like a farmer and you sounded normal. He's just like, "This is my dad." He's like, "Oh, right there. What are you, Scrumpy Jack?" "Dad, shh, trying to be cool." you're getting my tractor there.
Like Steve was selling fruit and veg out the back of his car at the training ground, so it kind of been that much of a shock to the rest of the players, really.
Well, that leads us beautifully into one of the great, great anecdotes here. Like Steve had it in his mind that he'd make a fortune if he went to sell strawberries to the crowds at Wimbledon, but someone had already pinched his spot and he had to sell them at a housing estate in Guildford instead. Great stuff, Steve. Great stuff.
Okay, Aldershot. Aldershot were the lower league's crazy gang.
He was very happy here, wasn't he? He loved being at Aldershot.
It was a collection of misfits, and I think, yeah, he was at home there.
Yeah.
He loved being there. They're all kind of... whatever, all a bit mad, I suppose, ultimately. And he scored 9 goals, was player of the season, but he got sold because they're running out of money. They actually did run out of money and went bust in 1992. Yeah. He was there in 1990, and they sold him for 75 grand to pay some bills, but he didn't keep the wolf from the door.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, the money. They got, like, Aldershot bought him for 14 grand from Palace, 14 grand. He received a 12 grand signing on fee, and he was on 350 quid a week. So yeah, that's different world of football, eh? Different world of football.
Yeah, I wonder what level you'd be getting £350 a week now.
Yeah, low. Yeah, 6th or 7th division, right? I think yeah, even like League Two, they're on decent money.
Yeah. So, Cambridge. He was at Cambridge for nearly 4 years. Claridge is, like he says towards the end of the book, he's always described when they went up to the Premier League and stuff, he's always described as a journeyman pro. And I counted, I think he moved 29 times in his career.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, like this, as you say, this book was written in 97. And I think I've got a newer edition of the book to you because it also talks about his... Coca-Cola Cup final goal for Leicester.
Oh, no, there's none of that in this one.
So this is a later edition of the book.
Tom Doran, you sent me a bad book.
You certainly did. Not up to date. Like, could have at least sent you some facsimile pages. Oh, dear. Poor show. But yeah, so there's a little bit more in that. But even after that, Even after 98, when this book is written, he's like 32. He has like another 9 or 10 clubs.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was looking on Wikipedia at his teams. Yeah. Nonstop.
And he does all right at all of them. Like, I mean, some of them it's real piecemeal, one here, but he's playing league football into his 40s.
Yeah. He played one game. He became a player manager later. He at Portsmouth, and maybe it was at Millwall or Luton later, but and he became the manager of Salisbury, who obviously are not associated with football. But he played a game for them as a 51-year-old.
Yeah, he loves the game and
Loves
he's
the
not
game.
tired from training.
He's not tired from training. But okay, Cambridge. He was there for
So
nearly
this is
4 years.
where he, yeah, sorry.
Sorry.
So this is where he becomes like a name in football, you know, to the point I think I would have heard for him when he was playing for Cambridge, because I used to love the lower leagues. I used to like poring over the lower leagues as a kid. And yeah, what a team it was. Played up front with a certain big Dion Dublin.
Yeah, and was Liam Dash in this team? He played with him later at Birmingham as well.
Yeah, that's right. Liam Daish. I was associated. He's an Irish fellow, right?
He was an Irish international, but like not a regular, because that was a time when we had like, McGrath and players like that. But he did play for Ireland, yeah.
But yeah, this is where he makes a name for himself. And Cambridge at this point are on the move, eh? They get two promotions under John Beck from the bottom division. In modern money, they go from League Two to League One, from League One to the
The championship.
Championship.
Yeah.
And they even get into the playoffs to get into the what would have been the first season of a Premier League.
Yeah, but they don't make
He
it.
says the Premier League are terrified about this because it'll be like having another Wimbledon in there.
Yeah, essentially they're too small. They don't have big enough a name, and it would have been bad for the league, I suppose. Ultimately, is what he says. But
Because of the brand of football they're playing as well.
this and the Birmingham stuff were probably the most interesting parts of the book, weren't they?
Yeah, no, I'd say so. Because, I mean, John Beck is a name I'm very familiar with. He was absolutely associated with this industrial brand of football, growing the grass in the corners. He'd say he'd sub you if you just didn't. If he tried to cut inside once, he'd sub you. He played out wide, Claridge. And if he didn't run the line and cross it in, he would take you off immediately.
Yeah, and the very first time he was named by Beck, and he played with Beck, so he thought that he was going to have a good relationship with him. But Beck is obviously a maniac, and he shows up for he's named in first game, and he always plays in filthy boots, and he explains why he just thinks whatever, better group or something ridiculous. But and Beck sees the boots and says, "Okay, you're off the team."
Yeah, he's one of them, very much a drill sergeant. Hey, cut your
Drill
hair.
sergeant, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cut your hair if your hair's not like how I like it. But you can't argue with his results, can you? Like, I
Well,
mean, he
Claridge
took.
does. Claridge does repeatedly argue with his.
Well, that's a, yeah, I wanted to point that out. It's like, oh, maybe we could have done more if he. So basically, I mean, he's very complimentary about his defensive organization, right? He's happy with that. He's even happy with the midfield. But he reckons you need to give attacking players a little bit more leeway, eh? It can't just be so scripted. You've got to give an attacking player a bit of leeway to cut inside, try a few tricks. And he says if John Beck had allowed his team to be a bit more fluid in the final third, he could have taken it into the Premier League. But come on, he took Cambridge to the playoffs for the Premier League.
Did it remind you at all of Pep and Grealish?
I mean,
Let Jack be Jack. Come on.
well, I'm with you there, lad. I'm with you there, although I'm pretty sure no one has ever made the comparison between John Beck and Pep Guardiola before.
But they have got similar, maniacal approaches to the system. They're both system players, or system managers.
No, Lionel. No, I didn't say beat five men and knock it in, did I? I said get down the wing. Hoof it in the corner.
I think there is a similarity there.
Well, and look again, they're both very successful, aren't they? Both very, very successful managers. I mean, that's it. If you take away the like thinking of it, like you do this when you have a ball here, you do this, and that player knows that you're going to do that. I get it, man. Cambridge have
Yeah.
never had it so good.
In Fever Pitch, when he's following Cambridge, a college, it's Cambridge he follows, isn't it? It's not this Cambridge, is it? As in this period Cambridge, it's earlier.
Yeah, I think it probably is early. I think it's probably early 80s.
Yeah, okay.
I think that makes sense. Yeah, otherwise that would have been fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah. A good story from Claridge when he was playing for Cambridge. Beck, you know, he had this thing where all the players had to have cold showers and they'd have ice buckets drawn on them and stuff like this. But one of the they were brought to some army training camp, a military base for training camp. And because it's close
He
to
told his
home,
wife he'd gone to Scotland. I can't tell her that.
because it's close to home, he couldn't ignore the siren song of the Portsmouth fields, the rolling hills outside Portsmouth. So he stole out in the middle of the night and he went and stayed in his folks' house. But because it's a military thing, you know, they're starting at 6 o'clock in the morning, which meant Claridge had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And Claridge said that he usually doesn't go to sleep until about three, so it was difficult. So he was driving back to this base and he crashed his car. And he managed to get back there and climb in the window and get into the bed. And then he's leaving. He's like, okay, I need another car. So he just stole the goalkeeper's car. didn't tell him he was taking the car and just fucked off in the goalkeeper's car.
As he said, he shouldn't have left his keys lying around, should he? There you go, I'll teach him.
Yeah, what a mess Steve Claridge was.
Would have, I mean, that going to sleep at like not going to sleep at 3 o'clock. I mean, I think he talks about a little thing where he knocks on his new teammate's door, who are they going to be rooming with, and he says he could see his face fall as he saw it as Steve Claridge. Oh God. It's going to be
Claridge.
you, like cutting chunks out of his hair with his moldy old boots and watching TV till 3 a.m.
Yeah. Watching soft porn in Swedish hotels.
Yeah, that was a real. There's another classic Claridge anecdote. Yeah, see, I think that must have been fun, like in the 90s when porn wasn't absolutely ubiquitous.
Yeah, there
But
you
there's a
go.
couple of porno stories which he really enjoys, close as we get to sex. Not what I imagine Steve Claridge is a much of a shagger, but maybe he is, right? I mean, maybe that's why he lied about going to Magaluf and stuff, like, because he was
Well,
up to.
Mandy obviously thinks so, yeah. And she'd know, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I guess she would. I could just imagine Steve Claridge out in the 90s, like, with his kicker boots on, like, shaved head. Oh, I knew a million of Steve Claridge's.
Like a very, very loose white shirt buttoned up to his collar kind of thing.
Yeah, the old white shirt and kicker boots. That was a look.
So he had a tempestuous relationship with your man Beck. As you said, ultimately he just thought that they wouldn't let them play. And he's magnanimous, I think, Claridge. And I don't actually mean that in a disingenuous way. He had problems with Beck, but he would credit him for certain things. And he did say that Beck would he too would kind of change his mind. He'd say, oh well, he'd kind of, him and Claridge would fall out, but Beck would forgive him and stuff like that. So he did stay there for all of that period, you know. And it's not like he's a 30 goal a season player. He was scoring goals, but I think in one season he scored 20 for Birmingham, but more than 20, maybe scored 25 actually. But generally he's not all that prolific, is he?
No, he's not at all. I mean, I think here, I mean, he would say if it had not been Beck, he would have scored more because he would have a chance to have a bit more creativity. But once more, I'm in the John Beck camp here. Like, I think John Beck was a good manager for a small team, incremental gains, doing everything right.
Yeah, it's not an incremental game to go from the third division to the to almost into the Premier League, isn't it? But
And if that means you're going to put piping hot water in the shower of the opponents, like, and they're dressing in the dark, then so be it. Like, make it a horrible place to come. I get that. Like, that's a fun side of the game. I guess that's what it tells from a boot camp, right? I mean, that's the side of the game that's entirely gone.
and he I like the story about himself and Beck had an actual physical fight at halftime once. And this is kind of where I say that Claridge kind of seems to, Beck and Claridge both seem to be willing to forgive each other for his time. So that, like, he's done whatever to piss off Beck, and Beck comes in and has taken him off or whatever. And they start fighting, and Claridge boxes him in the eye. And but then at the end of the game, they'd lost, and Beck comes in. Says something like, if only the rest of you had shown the same passion or whatever that old Steve did when he boxed me in the eye. So that was nice enough.
It's funny, isn't it, when you get commended for losing your temper at work. I called a boss a fucking prick once. He goes, "I've been waiting for that. I've been waiting for that." Said, "No, you haven't. Shows you care. Shows I hate you."
So he was off to Luton then. Didn't work out.
Yeah, Luton didn't go well at all.
No, David Pleat. David Pleat. Did you know that David Pleat was this kind of visionary manager? Because that's the way he's made out in the book.
Good evening, everybody. Yes, I did know that. No, he was magnificent for Luton in the 80s, right? I mean, that's him skipping across the park.
I have
They won
seen
the
that one all
Littlewoods
right.
Cup.
Yeah, I've seen that one all right. Yeah. But yeah, it didn't work out. He only played 17 games for Pleat. And Pleat was, in a way, it was funny because Claridge hated Beck. And then he went to play for Pleat at Luton, and Luton was the exact opposite. And the structure wasn't there. And apparently this kind of really put Claridge in a spin. And it didn't work out from there. And he was back, sent back to Cambridge, but Beck had moved on at this point.
Yeah, all the time here, the money's getting bigger and bigger, though. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, he goes to Luton, doesn't work out, but they sign him back for 200 grand, which must be big money for Luton. And he gets a big pay rise. This is when he starts making money, right? Cambridge, second time around.
When they went back to Cambridge, and Beck was gone, and the wheels kind of did come off. So maybe you're right, Al. Maybe Beck. See, he didn't work out for Beck later either. He went to Lincoln and wherever he went afterwards, it didn't really work out. But the Cambridge thing, they kind of crashed and burned. They were relegated when beaten by. It must be. It's funny, isn't it? Like it happens later with Claridge going up, but on the last day of the season. And they're playing here in the second division, so the equivalent of the championship. They are playing West Ham, and West Ham go up to the Premier League, and Cambridge go down to the second division, or what would now be League One. That's mad, isn't it? Like, just the difference for those two teams and the other follows.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, look at West Ham now. Where are Cambridge United?
Yeah. Anyway, so they went to Birmingham, and I like this stuff as well because maybe up until this point, with the occasional name like Liam Dash and stuff like this, I didn't really know many people. But at Birmingham, I started to recognize a few of the names: Barry Fry, David Sullivan, Karen Brady, all those kinds of characters I would be familiar with.
Again, here I really am, and this is when I really did start enjoying it because they talk about signing Kevin Francis, and I remember that transfer at the time. I've got a feeling Forest were in the same division as Birmingham, where we feared them. And like big Kevin Francis, he really was. He was 6 foot 8, absolute mountain of a man. Like it was
Right.
really standout. It was exciting to watch him. Like I liked Birmingham back then, which seems incredible now to me.
And Barry Fry, former Busby Babe.
Yeah, I knew about that, like, but yeah, as they say, as Steve Clary says, what he knows about tactics, you could write in a postage stamp. He's just like things that move fastly and score goals.
A kind of a wheeler dealer type, right? Who was always, Clary said in the period that he was there, he played with 23 different strike partners. Barry Fry was just constantly buying and selling people, but he liked Claridge.
I mean, he was the original wheeler dealer, old Barry Fry, and looks like a used car salesman, talks like a used car salesman. Everything about him is a used car salesman. Really one of the great characters in the game. Really, really one of the great characters. I'm very fond of
Yeah.
Barry Fry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they had a squad. I mean, I'm pulling this. I think they had a squad of like 48 people in the late 90s. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing how huge their squad was.
Yeah, David Sullivan had come from the soft porn world to take on football in Birmingham City.
Dildo Brothers.
The Dildo Brothers.
Yeah, well, they got called that. So, because David Gold recently died, didn't he? Released in the last year at West Ham. I think it was a foreign chairman, I believe, who called them the Dildo Brothers. Like,
That's
yeah.
fun. Steve Claridge seems to start badly with teams, or started badly with teams, and it was no different at Birmingham. And he was in a car with two teammates listening to a phone in when some fella called in to describe Steve Claridge as the worst player ever to play for Birmingham City. It's quite nice, I thought.
And that is a long list.
Yeah, that is a long list.
I mean, I could name some pretty awful players.
But things did improve. But he started playing well, and as I said, Barry Fry liked him, so he was in the team a lot, and he was scoring goals. But there was a problem, and the problem's name was Karen Brady.
Yeah, Karen Brady, not a straight talker. Didn't she felt she deceived him a lot. She was always lying to him, lying about the money, wanted more, wouldn't give him more. And he was resentful.
He said he approached her. Barry Fry had told him that he took a pay cut to go there from Cambridge. And Barry Fry told him, just sign this and we'll get you back up to the money that you're on at Cambridge and more and whatever. Clara says, fine. And Clara usually didn't have an agent. And then he says he went to Karen Brady later the following year and said, look, this is what Barry Fry said. And then Karen Brady said, okay. And she took her dog out of her car. Walked the dog around the car park and then came back and says, Barry Fry doesn't get to make the decisions about how much you get paid. What an odd scene, you know. Just a minute, stay there. Just walk this dog quickly around the car park and come back to
Now, I've got some bad news for you upon my return from this dog walk.
you.
Yeah, also, that was made more complicated by the fact that Karen Brady was in a relationship with one of the players, good old Paul Pescasolido.
Would you say Pesky Salad or Pesky Salido?
Well, I just said Pescasolido, so I'll
He
go with
did.
that.
He did say Pesky Salado. Yeah. There's a nice story about Barry Fry, not from when Claridge was there, but he references it from another player who played with Fry, was telling him that when they were in the lower leagues, this particular player was on the field. Like Barry Fry would just scream at you and then immediately forget what he'd said to you, this kind of thing. A real character. But your man was having a howler of a game, and Fry was wearing a suit, and he marched onto the pitch to shout at your man, and it was like lower leagues in this kind of filthy, muddy pitch, and your man turned around and boxed Barry Fry, and Barry Fry fell face first into the mud. It's kind of nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it is nice. And then Barry Fry comes in and goes, "You want a pint, mate? You want a pint?"
That's it, yeah.
He also tells a story of how Barry Fry, in a rage, threw a cup of tea at one of the players. And the player licked his lips and said, "Barry, I told you I'd take two sugars," which is a cool response, isn't it? After someone throwing a cup of tea at you. Good for
Yeah, that's
him.
good. Did you see that stuff as well? Claridge says that he was boxed. He himself was boxed three times by fans in the course of his career. And each time, you know, like he's kind of retrieving a ball or whatever, each time someone kind of leans, like once he was kind of sitting on the bench, I think. One another time he was retrieving a ball, and each time someone kind of boxed him, and then he couldn't identify who it was. It was just kind of like a sneaky second shooter in the grassy knoll type of box.
I guess that did happen in the old days. And you could get away with it, right? The crowd would hide you.
And he said that every player has experienced this. How would Bruno Fernandes react to that?
Yeah, Bruno Fernandes would not like it, would he?
No, he
They're
wouldn't like
so
that.
pampered now, eh? They don't
Ah,
even
oh, those
get.
goddamn
Yeah,
footballers.
they don't even get hit by random people in the crowd anymore.
Salido thing was ultimately, he kind of alludes to the fact that this is what Wood paid to his time at Birmingham, because Brady kind of moved him on, essentially wanted rid of him, even though he was doing well. Paul Pescasolido was there for a while, and then he went to West Brom, but then they sold Claridge and immediately got Pescasolido back. And at this point, Karen Brady and Paul Pescasolido were married, so he certainly seems to believe that that's the reason that he was pushed out of Birmingham.
Very quickly, can we just go back to John Beck? I'll just tell an
Sure.
anecdote. And there's also one of John Beck's less conventional training regimes was he hypnotized them all. He hypnotized every player. And there was one poor unfortunate Danny O'Shea who really did go under. And apparently he was, they're all sitting down. And he was riding his chair like a horse going for the Grand National. But yeah, I mean that's another it's another try, eh? I mean, we talk about systems. You think Pep hypnotizes the Man City players?
He would have them lobotomized if he had his way, I'd say.
Yeah, I think he would.
Yeah.
Look at the results, Johnny. Look at the results.
So when he left Birmingham, he had a thyroid problem. So he'd been taking heart medication since he was a kid, and he was just totally out of it. So when he went to Leicester, he was rubbish. And I was interested in the Leicester stuff because I wanted to hear a bit more about Martin O'Neill because he was playing under Martin O'Neill. But he doesn't really get into it, does he?
He says Martin O'Neill's got poor timekeeping, which frankly surprised me.
Yeah. So Martin, we have a funny relationship, I think, with Martin O'Neill from his time as Ireland manager, because, you know, he was a big coup for us at the time, and there was like an Irish billionaire who came in to pay his wages. So it was very much kind of, we were punching above our weight in terms of what we could afford. But he was a bit of a prick about our team.
Well, I mean, I've also got a funny relationship with O'Neill because at Forest, man, we desperately wanted him in the 90s, desperately wanted him. Like, there used to be big chants. I remember when we were getting relegated and we were all singing, "Stand up if you want O'Neill," as our manager, as he was managing Leicester. We were getting relegated. So I guess that was a little bit optimistic. But yeah, we all really wanted him, but we got him 20 years too late. And yes, he was absolutely shocking at Forest. Terrible, 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 terrible.
And that Leicester team was fun, wasn't it?
Well, not for me, Johnny. Not for me in the 90s. It was a miserable thing. Like, and that was the golden age of Leicester at the time. I mean, they've since obviously surpassed it, but
Yeah.
those were salad days for the Leicester lads back in the 90s. Oh, we finished in the top half, like cup finals and
What
stuff.
was it like? He mentions Muzzy, is it? But was it Matty Elliott? Was that the centre back who'd be trundled up to the front every now and again? Kind of
Yeah,
a.
big Matt Elliott. Yeah, he was a player. I mean, I know now. I mean, we really are in my region now. I believe I used to date the woman that Muzzy Izzet went on to marry. Thank you very much.
There's the sex that you were looking for the
But I'm
la
providing it. There was no sex with the future Mrs. Elson. We were teenagers, innocent, sweet teenagers.
yeah, okay, that's
The
funny.
future Mrs. Izzet. What did I say? Giving it all away again. Like, let's tell my story again without me saying any names.
any what about Steve Guppy? What about the other, all the rest of the players from that?
Well, Martin O'Neill's daughters went to the same school that I did, although very lot younger than me.
Okay.
So yeah, I've got that one, but I didn't abuse them or anything like that. Like verbally abuse them. There was no abuse at all. I don't even know what they looked like. They were much younger than me, and I didn't know who they were, so I didn't get stuck into them for their dad being the Leicester manager. But yeah,
Okay.
there you go. So Leicester City at that time were a reasonable part of my life. I mean, I heard about them all the time. I grew up only 15 miles from Leicester, so I got to hear all about fucking Leicester City a lot and how good they were. And they were good back in those days. I mean, I
Yeah,
could pretty much
that's
name that team.
they had the walkers on their shirts, remember?
Yeah, it was classic. Absolutely classic. I mean,
But yeah,
classic
so
90s Premier League.
and it was one Steve Claridge who provided it. So he started very poorly with Leicester and then turned it around, and they were not doing all that well, and then they kind of slowly inched their way up the first division as it was at the time, equivalent of the championship, and they got to the playoffs and they were drawing one all against Palace
Yes.
and it looked like it was going to penalties, but then somebody laid it off, I guess, or it was kind of a clearance really, wasn't it? And Claridge absolutely belts it in from the edge of the box. It is a nice goal. I watched it.
Yeah, I watched it too. Just sat up and winked at him, eh? Like, and
Yeah,
he
that's a
smashed
nice
it.
nice expression. Yeah.
Yeah, and back then, that was, since that time, Leicester have gone on to win the league and the FA Cup. But I mean, at the time, that was big news.
Yeah, well, that's it really. Like the book kind of finishes there. He kind of talks a bit about where football is, and you know, he'd like to be a manager someday, and he did become a manager. I read on Wikipedia, right, that he was manager, maybe it was Millwall, and he was fired before he even played a game because they changed owners, and the owners came in and was like, well, if he's manager, we're going to be relegated. So they just sacked him.
No, but he had a lot of non-league management. I think he was at Salisbury, right? I think that's right, for like 6 or 7 years.
6 or 7 years. He's currently the manager of Fleetlands in the Wessex League Division One. So Al, what did you think of, what did you think of Tales from the Boot Camps?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I did. It was a lovely change of pace. Again, these books are like a little passageway back to my youth. Hearing the names Ricky Otto again, I'm just pleased to hear about them. Like, yeah, so I enjoyed this book. He missed some stuff out, I reckon, but overall,
what did he vote?
I mean, just nothing about his family or his relationships. Just nothing. I don't know. I guess people don't want that, right? They must do this. They must. People don't want to hear about your family, but I do. I want to hear about when your wife's mad at you for your lies.
You're right there, yeah.
I mean, nothing at all. His dad sounds like a farmer.
Yeah.
His mum loves him. I mean, that's it. Like, that's it. It's just terrible, terrible driving.
Yeah, and his mother is a bad driver. He reckons she's caused 40 accidents.
I think if he thinks she's a bad driver, it means she's a good driver. Although, yes, he does say that she's caused many, many accidents. Oh, he's a bad driver. Anyway, so how many wrecked cars would you give this out of 5?
Yeah, how many discarded apple cores? Yeah, wrecked. I think I'd give it maybe 3, 3.5. I'll give it 3.5.
Yeah, I think this book is exactly as good as Steve Claridge was as a player.
Oh, God, I'll give it 3.
Yeah, it ain't Premier League. It ain't. But it's a fine yarn, and I know a good deal more about the Weymouth sprinkler system than I ever expected to know.
Yeah. I kind of liked Claridge in the sense that he was an oddball, kind of a goofy, well, maybe not goofy, but he's odd and unusual and kind of, there's a certain kind of bimbo quality to Claridge, I thought, but a likable one.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very likable. If they're making a film about his life, he'd be played by Rodney Trotter, right? That's who I see when I hear his voice on the page. I was late again. Oh, you're late.
I was thinking more like Luke Wilson.
Well, I'm sure he'd take that. He'd take that all day, like it.
Yeah, so 3.5. So, okay, Al, what are we doing
well,
next?
Just one more shout out to Tom. Thank you very much, Tom, for sending us the book and giving it. And we did enjoy it. We did.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tom. I
guess
will.
It followed Maradona. So it's difficult for him. Difficult to follow Maradona in almost anything.
Yeah. Okay, so the next book is also a recommendation from my friend Samyak, and it is Arsene Wenger's My Life in Red and White.
Oh, Wenger. Yeah, he's an interesting character, eh?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the... I might stop reading it after the Japan part.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best bits, eh? I'm fascinated how he did at Monaco. Yeah, okay, so that will be next in 2 weeks' time, Johnny, right?
Exactly, yeah. Okay.
So check us out on the Adamola Bookman socials and like and subscribe. It really helps. Thanks very much, guys.
Yeah, thanks very much. And thank you, Alistair.
And thank you, Johnny.